Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here, really excited about the subject of today's show, The Legacy of Frank Frazetta, just like it says in the title. The Frazetta Museum is open again. There is a new Kickstarter campaign for some amazing T-shirts of four Frazetta paintings that have never been represented this way before. Moises Chuan is going to join us for the first segment to talk about the Kickstarter and really describe the products and how cool it is. There's only 7 days left in the campaign. We say 9 days on the interview, but I don't want you to be confused. It is 7 days left of this campaign. And then we're going to talk to Frank Frazetta Jr., live from the Frazetta Museum, and just get a little more insight into his dad and what an incredible guy Frank Frazetta was. If you don't know the name, you certainly know the art. Pieces like Death Dealer and Berserker. Frazetta was born February 9th, 1928. He passed away May 10th, 2010, and was an incredible prodigy artist even as a kid. His first comic book work was the 8-page story Snowman, and started working immediately for things like Prize Comics and did John Wayne comics in the 40s. He also made comic strips. He did work on the Buck Rogers covers for Famous Funnies, and he worked on Little Abner for Al Capp for a long time. But then he also made his own strip, Johnny Comet, one of my personal favorites. And he assisted Dan Barry on Flash Gordon. But really exploded in the 60s doing fantasy cover art for a long stretch of the Robert Howard Conan books, the Edgar Rice Burroughs Tarzan and John Carter from Mars books. And then for Creepy and Eerie would do these amazing, beautiful covers and movie posters as well. We talk about it with Frank Jr. And then things really just exploded. And, Frank and his wife were smart enough to start a mail order service for posters representing their art. And as I say, growing up as a kid in the 70s and 80s, all over the place, vans, dorm rooms, calendars, Frank Frazetta art was everywhere. And it was just gorgeous fantasy art. So it's a real pleasure to speak to Frank, who can give us firsthand stories of his father, his process. And also, frankly, living up to the guy, because Frank Jr. tried to, with his dad's wishes, tried to explore doing art himself. It just wasn't his passion. And, he talks a bit about that. And, unfortunately, you might have heard that after Frank Sr. passed away and Frank's wife passed away, there was some infighting with the siblings of Frank Jr., what to do with the art collection. Luckily, they made peace after a rough start, and I'm glad Frank Jr. was able to continue things with the museum and his wife and her instrumental participation in keeping the thing going. Frank Jr. wanted us to absolutely know how important Lori Frazetta is to continuing the legacy of Frazetta with the Frazetta Museum. But it's in the Poconos. It sounds like it's a fantastic destination for a trip. And, it's, again, we get to get an insight in the man and the museum and the legacy, all three of those things. Frank Frazetta today is the subject of Word Balloon. Today's Word Balloon is brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you very much, League, for your support. You keep the show going, and there are newcomers that have joined on today, or this week, I should say, and I appreciate that. There are people that have re-upped and even expanded their subscriptions as well. So I thank you very much for supporting the show. If you'd like to subscribe to Word Balloon, if you think Word Balloon adds to your appreciation of the comics culture with these interviews, you can subscribe via Patreon. Pardon me. You can subscribe via Patreon at patreon.com/wordballoon or go to wordballoon.com and click on the Patreon ad there. It will take you directly to my Patreon page. But thank you for your support, League of Word Balloon listeners. So there you go. We'll give you information about the Kickstarter and where to go if you're interested in getting the T-shirts. But in the meantime, I want to start things off with Moises Chuan to talk about the campaign and what they're doing to support the Frazetta Museum with some pretty incredible T-shirts. So here's Moises Chuan now on Word Balloon. Moises Chuan, welcome to Word Balloon. We've had a lot of convention encounters, and now you're on the podcast. Welcome, dude.
Yeah, encounters would be one way to say it. Long time listener, first time guest, and I'm thrilled to be on. Thanks for having me, man.
Well, I'm excited about this Frazetta stuff that's going on with Kickstarter and all, and you're going to give us the lowdown on that, and then we're going to talk to Frank Jr. So tell me what's happening with this is for the Frazetta Museum, correct?
Right. And I got involved in this because a friend of mine who had previously done a Kickstarter that was to benefit Bernie and Liz Wrightson was getting together with Frank Jr., who I'm not going to waste too much of your time so that you can get to the true sign of the legacy. He did this this remastering re-release of Bernie Wrightson's Cycle of the Werewolf with some really cool extras, pins, buttons, you know, all that jazz. And I've been friends with Liz and Bernie for a number of years now, being on the con circuit, because anybody who's met them is friends with Liz and Bernie Wrightson.
I'm with you.
You know, I hate that there's a past tense attached to that at this point. But he did this really great job. I mean, he's a horrible human being, I should say, first of all. But that aside, the respect for the art, the respect for history, the respect for people who need somebody to stick up for them after the point that publishers aren't paying attention to them as much and doing as much heavy lifting for people as when they're in their prime. I mean, the beautiful thing is that, you know, like IDW is finishing that last Frankenstein book that Bernie was working on with Steve Niles. And that's wonderful. And that's great. But there's only so much that you can rely on publishers that you've worked with to make sure that the legacy is maintained. And there's certainly only so much that somebody can be expected to do when they're also in the process of, you know, dealing with the fact that they've lost, you know, somebody so dear and important to them. So despite the fact that Tim Doyle is a horrible human being who, you know, makes a few things that you might want to hang in your house. Despite all that, he got together with Frank Frazetta Jr. to do a Kickstarter to bring four of Frank Sr.'s most famous paintings into the world of silk screen prints for the first time.
Cool.
And make that kind of the really special way that people can directly support the Frazetta Museum, which Frank Jr. will tell you more about. But I know that we talked a little bit about this offline. I don't know if you're that familiar with the whole silk screen printing subculture that much. I know you're a big movie buff.
Well,
that's
certainly
anybody who listens to the shows knows.
We certainly have reps that, you know, are doing that thing now that you know, are certainly taking advantage of the art community here in Chicago. So the Tim Seeleys, the Mike Nortons, the Sean Doves, the Jill Thompsons, they're all, you know, cranking out stuff for the exploding you know, customized silk screening business that's going on right now. But feel free, continue and illuminate the listeners. I was going to say the readers.
Well, a weird bit of common thread that I have with Tim is that both of us at different times worked for the Alamo Drafthouse movie theater company based here in Austin. He was a co-creative director at Mondo, which started out being like a t-shirt shop in the bottom of the main Alamo Drafthouse theater, where they would do like iron-on transfer t-shirts, you know, with all kinds of weird and wacky stuff.
Sure.
And they started doing silk screen posters for different movies, whether they were doing a special event, like an outdoor screening of Jaws on a lake where everybody'd be in inner tubes and there'd be somebody swimming with a scuba mask with a shark fin going through the water, you know, neat, nifty, cool stuff like that. They started looking at the emerging collector's market for silk screen gig posters for rock bands.
Sure.
You know, that had become a thing, especially in the 90s. And a lot of these same designers, they're among the most talented designers, artists in the industry. They brought these people in to start doing alternate movie posters for these special events, these special screenings and so on. And it was very much a niche part of what they were doing. And the company from the beginning was called Mondo Tees because it was the t-shirt shop in the bottom of a movie theater. It was just a merch shop. But then these things started picking up this crazy amount of steam on the aftermarket as collector's items. Because I'm sure that you could probably name off a dozen movies right off the top of your head that you love the movie and you hate the poster. Right?
Sure. Absolutely.
Right? And so what you get is you have some of the most talented designers and artists in those industries taking their considerable skills and applying them to doing cool and interesting and different takes that you've never seen done. You know, a particularly colossal sized King Kong print, you know, for example.
Sure.
The prints that a lot of people came to know Mondo, and the reason that a lot of people, in the same way that you remember when people would just call video games Atari or just call video games Nintendo.
Sure.
So people will call these silkscreen prints. They'll say, oh, it's like a Mondo print, even if it's not actually Mondo doing it, because there are loads of companies that do these things where they privately commission the artists. They pay the licensing for the property. They make a poster of this stuff. People just call it a Mondo print because they got so deeply associated with it. And I would say the iconic posters that a lot of people know, which have now been reprinted onto shirts and, you know, you see them bootlegged all over the place at conventions, are these three original Star Wars trilogy prints for Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Jedi. Because I don't call the first one New Hope because I'm not a Philistine. And they're these gorgeous, very evocative, silhouette-based designs by one of the great artists on the planet, Ollie Moss. A lot of people know those designs. They have seen them. They have made them, you know, their backgrounds on their computers and so on. And especially when Mondo got that Star Wars license, as things had already been taking off for them for some time, it really exploded like crazy. And there was a lot more interest flowing into this niche market. And so what we have now are loads of different shops that do limited run silk screen prints of posters. And for those unfamiliar, I mean, you can look it up on Wikipedia. Again, I'm just getting in the way of Frank Frazetta Jr. and that's not a fair thing for me to do. You've got a series of screens that are used to lay down a color at a time. So if you have, say, a four color screen print, you have a very nice piece of paper and you've got four different impressions that you're putting down on the paper in a particular color of ink, and they're being layered over top, over top, over top. Mm-hmm. So it's a very it's in the world of Photoshop layers in computerized art, it's really easy to visualize that, where it used to be more of a, you saw the finished product and you assumed it just kind of like ran off of a printer. But it was a much more hand-pulled artisan process than that. So this is the long way around to explaining why this is such an insanely crazy deal, which anybody who knows Frank Frazetta's art, these beautiful, beautiful paintings, look at them and you go, that doesn't look like something that you can divide up into a few layers in Photoshop.
Yeah, into four layers, absolutely.
Yeah. So what Tim's guys have done is partnered with a printer who specializes in reproducing painted art in silkscreen prints. Cool. Where they're laying down multiple layers, sometimes of the exact same color, but in different orders, so that you're getting a true, faithful representation of the art.
Excellent.
That's a big, huge thing.
Sure.
Is making it as close to the original art as you can get without sacrificing detail, without sacrificing quality, and giving you something different than you can get in the most incredibly, insanely high-end, digitally printed thing. Every single one of these things is being hand-pulled. You're getting a pull of paint on each one of these screens that it goes through, and you can feel it, you can see it, you can smell it on the paper.
Cool.
You know, you're not just putting one laser brush of color on this stuff. This is serious, real deal, high quality stuff. The kind of stuff you take to a framing shop and have framed under museum glass.
Sure.
Because it looks that good. This is the first time that not only these paintings, but any of Frank Frazetta's paintings have been presented as screen prints. And the way that the Kickstarter works is it's set up effectively as an open edition for the regular versions of these prints. So as many people as back this thing, that is how many of them will be made, and that's it.
Okay.
There's no going back to the printer and running them off again. It's not a laser jet. It's not that kind of thing.
I'm with you.
So You stop me if any of these are unfamiliar. Death Dealer, you know this?
Of course. That's one of the main classics. Absolutely, go on.
With respect to the intellectual property holders of the Robert E. Howard estate, Barbarian, you're familiar with which painting I'm referring to?
Yeah, I think we can do the math and figure out what Barbarian was depicting then. Go on.
Brycrom, indeed. Silver Warrior, this is one that you've seen in one or 12 places, yes?
Sure, absolutely.
And the Huns, okay?
The Huns?
The Huns. So,
is the Huns the Molly Hatchet Frazetta, or is that not one of the four?
No, it would the Huns is one of the four that's right. part of the Kickstarter.
But I don't know. But, do you know was the Huns used for Molly Hatchet's Flirting with Disaster back in the day? Because that was a classic Frazetta that beyond the Frazetta fan world certainly made an impact in the rock world as well. Do you remember Molly Hatchet Flirting with Disaster?
See, this is why I'm getting out of the way of Frank Jr. because he's much more the subject matter expert on that kind of stuff.
All right, we'll leave it for Frank then. We'll table that and move on. But that's terrific, and it's surprising, and I'm going to ask Frank. I'm assuming that maybe back in the earlier days, because the Frazetta posters were always such a big part of the family business and everything, did they do iron-on T-shirts back in the day of some of these iconic things? I mean, I just remember
they had to have. Yeah. And I mean, there's an exclusive Frazetta Worlds T-shirt that's part of the different backer awards and everything. Okay. To rattle off a couple of things, like there's a foil set version of them where they're all printed on holofoil paper, iridescent foil paper.
Wow.
Because people are into that stuff.
Sure.
You know. It's a thing. You know, you get matched numbers. That's a thing for people. There's a T-shirt I mentioned. There's a set of enamel pins. The enamel pins are hip with the kids these days. You know, those damn kids and their rock music. And the craziest thing, honestly, in the whole Kickstarter is one of those ugly holiday sweaters with Death Dealer on it, which is kind of for me the most aside from the prints themselves. It's the most attractive thing to me because I don't wear sweaters like that, but I would wear a Death Dealer Christmas sweater.
Be a hit at your geek Christmas party with a Frazetta holiday sweater. That's fantastic. Very funny.
There, you know, you can go individually on the prints. You can get the whole set and get all four
of them.
Excellent.
That's great too, because honestly, and I think it's great when people can afford all four pieces, but if they want to buy one piece, I think that's a good deal as well.
Well, here's the other thing is the thing I mentioned earlier, there have been really beautiful high-end giclée prints of these pieces done, but the pricing has put it outside of the realm of affordability for a lot of people. And the beauty of silkscreen prints is that, yes, it is a very intensive hand-wrought process and all that, but these are reasonably priced compared to spending a couple thousand dollars.
Agreed.
You know, on something like a giclée.
Absolutely.
You know, these are, you know, they're hand embossed. They're on nice, high quality paper. They will look handsome and gorgeous and are suitable for a place of honor in your home. And you can break the bank on the frame if you want, you know.
Sure.
Anybody who's had anything custom framed knows what I'm talking about. But when it comes to just getting the art and making it accessible for people who have the T-shirt budget and don't have the I'm going to put it in my gallery room.
Right, absolutely.
Where I keep my works of art, you know, that kind of thing. Like that's the thing that excited me about it. Aside from the core mission of the proceeds of this going toward keeping the Frazetta Museum alive.
Absolutely.
In the first place.
No, he's you know, one of the unsung heroes of comics. I think people forget. And then you bring up Frazetta, and it's, oh, of course, Frazetta. Jesus, yeah. Look at the body of work. Look at the amazing things that he's done, not only in paperbacks, but his comic work speaks for itself, the movie posters that he made over the years as well. No, he's a genius, you know. I always forget the name of the documentary. Was it Playing with Fire or?
Playing with Fire. Playing with Fire sounds right.
Yeah, and I know Fire is definitely in the title, but yeah, the Frazetta documentary they made.
Painting with Fire.
Painting with Fire, like
Painting
obviously,
with Fire, yeah.
Obviously. Is so terrific and really does, you know, I'm so glad that Frank Sr. was able to do that before he passed, and it wasn't just a bunch of people talking about Frank. Bernie included, obviously, in that documentary, as I recall. No, the guy's work is amazing, and the museum itself needs to survive. And I'm really glad that Frank Jr. is doing everything he can to keep it going, because, again, I don't think this man's work should be forgotten.
Well, one of the reasons, you know, that I started listening to Word Balloon early on was because you did these in-depth interviews with people that cared about the craft. You dug deeper than people would generally do in something like a dashed-off website interview, something like that. And in becoming a comics podcaster myself, albeit my show's been on hiatus for about a year, it's coming back, I swear to God. The thing that I run into all the time, that I'm sure that you do too, is you start interviewing an artist, and if they are remotely interested in paint, if they are remotely interested in fantasy, the first two words that come out of their mouth are always Frank Frazetta.
Absolutely.
Well, Frank Frazetta, of course.
Yeah.
Frank Frazetta, of course. I mean, Frank Frazetta is the beginning. He's the alpha and the omega.
Absolutely.
That's where it begins and that's where it ends for me. You know, you talk to Greg Capullo, you talk to Bernie. I mean, you talk to
Bernie.
Jock, you know, like loads of these artists. And his style is undeniable. The iconic presentation of the figure, the way that it draws the eye, is something that, I mean, it permeates all of the best stuff in comics.
Yeah, and it hasn't aged in any bad way. And I loved, you know, a few years ago when, was it Image that, through Image, that they had the Frazetta comic, a new series where, you know, they kind of based new stories on the original art that was, you know, then you got the covers where the Frazetta paintings and stuff, and then inside you got great stories. Do you know what I'm talking
about,
Jay Photos?
Yeah, that sounds right. I want to say, well,
yeah, I can't remember which imprint it was.
I know that it existed, but I forget which publisher it is,
yeah.
which is why I work adjacent to comics and not in comics.
Well, and then also, you know, I mean, I know that in the 90s, too, during my blind spot years, there was a series of that stuff. And also, I think Frank Sr. worked with Danzig for a while, and they were planning something. I know my buddy Sal Abinanti told me that he ran into Danzig and Frazetta together, and it was his one face-to-face with Frank Frazetta. So I'm bummed that I missed it. I got to talk to Bashki. That's the closest I got. So at least I got a Frazetta collaborator to
you get to hear stories from Sal, who I've yet to meet Sal, but I, like, you know, I'm friends with Tiziano and
sure.
like all these people that are in the orbit of the man, the myth, the legend, the man who steers the USS Alex Ross. But yeah, like those kinds of stories just fascinate me. This is a minor tangent, but I think you'll permit it. A friend of mine, Lewis Black, not the comedian, but the co-founder of the South by Southwest Festival here in Austin.
Cool.
He talked about being a kid growing up in New Jersey, and he and his buddy Len would go across the bridge into New York, and they would hang out in bars as children with this guy named Otto, who did comic books.
Oh.
And his friend Len was Leonard Maltin.
Oh, that's fun. So who was the Otto?
So was Otto Binder.
It was Otto Binder. Okay, very good. For that, yeah. I thought it was going to be Otto Preminger, the fine director. As I said, that's cool. Jesus. Otto Binder is very awesome and stuff. We had Bill, bless me, Bill Shelley, who just did that wonderful Otto Binder biography a couple years ago and did the Kurtzman book recently as well.
There's so many of those like crazy stories of, so I was in a bar and Stan Lee was shouting across it at so-and-so and, you know, somebody or another was doing a rewrite on something on a napkin, you know, just crazy stories that there are plenty of them that are out there and float around and they get retold, but there's plenty of stuff that you just, you don't hear those really incredible anecdotes of, you know, what happens at the bar con after the con's
sure.
closed for the day.
I'm glad I got to meet and talk to Joe Kubert for a bit at a bar con kind of moment.
Yeah.
Right before he passed. It was great to meet Joe Simon before he passed. You know, so yeah, I've got, you know, and then of course the wonderful Bronze Age creators that thankfully are still with us, and a couple silver guys in there, because technically Neil Adams and Denny O'Neill are pre-Bronze Age. Creator, so I think technically Silver Age creator. So I got them on my you know, encounter list, and certainly guys that I've talked to. And pleased to say, I won't say who to keep it a mystery, Word Balloon listeners, but one of those gentlemen will be back very shortly on Word Balloon with a new conversation. So I look forward to that. It's going to be a busy November.
Well, I tell you, I honestly, you know, I've done enough warming up of the crowd for Junior, but the thing I'll leave you with is again, thanks to you for doing the show that you've been doing, because it's why I do my show, Giant Size, and talking about those experiences you have at a con that you never in a million years would have fathomed. You know, I'm 1 or 12 years younger than you. Just a touch. I'm not a baby. I'm not one of these like 20 somethings. I'm in my 30s. I'm not that young, John. But I grew up pulling comics off of spinner racks, and I was reading the Fantastic Four when Tom DeFalco and Paul Ryan did this uninterrupted like 5-year run. Like the last time somebody did 5 years on the Fantastic Four.
I'm with you. Go on.
And the next to last convention that Paul Ryan did before he suddenly passed, I ended up with my buddy co-hosting a Legends of Comics panel with Paul Ryan, Howard Mackey, and Val Merrick on it.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. It's a good triple there, right there. Absolutely,
and
man.
Howard and Paul were buddies and knew each other. Val didn't know them, but they crossed over just enough.
Okay.
That they had stories about some of the same people and the way that things moved and changed and everything.
From the
and,
70s to the 80s.
Yeah.
80s, obviously. Yeah, in 2000s, I guess, in Howard's case.
Just certainly. Like the completely different nature of everybody going into the office at Marvel in New York and working. There's this amazing anecdote that I couldn't even reproduce if I tried my hardest to get within an inch of how well they did it. But they talked about the pranks they would play on people where, Paul Ryan would show up and nobody knew what he looked like because he always mailed in his work, and he shows up wearing a 3-piece suit and people think he's like with Marvel Corporate. And, you know, this is as the bankruptcy is impending, and, you know, he's like, oh no, a suit's coming in from upstate. What's going on? Pranking shooter, like just stuff that I had never heard that I don't know had necessarily been told before. There's so many stories like that that, you know, if people who listen to your show don't regularly go to cons, don't regularly go out there and make new friends and that kind of thing. Doing that has changed my life for the better. It's part of the reason that I'm on your show right now talking about this great thing that, as we speak, has 9 days left on this Rosetta Kickstarter. So if you can contribute to it, I got involved with it specifically because of the cause behind it. I've got enough stuff in my house. This stuff will not look bad by any means. But get yourself some neat stuff and support a worthy cause that helps continue the legacy and the story of Frank Frazetta and his influence and work.
Excellent, Moises. Well, and thanks for the kind words, man. I really appreciate it. And everyone lately has been very kind about
– Just keep that fucker Tom King off your show. Just I've heard enough from him. He's selling so well.
He's coming
People
back.
Say they love
you
him.
Know
he's coming back.
He's doing too much. Well, he's doing too well lately. I'm sorry.
Then shut off the subscription. I'll come back when you have the first edition of the DC Bendis tapes.
Yeah, I know. How about that shit? I know. As we're recording, it's still the same day that they've made the announcement. And
how crazy is it that the first thing I thought of was, man, I wonder when Suntress is going to book him for Bendis tapes, because I got to get 3 hours, 3.5, 7 hours, however many hours, you know, his voice doesn't give out. I've got to hear him talk about this. This is crazy.
True. No, I intend to tie him down for a nice lengthy conversation, and we will we'll be having that in the days ahead. But first things first, really, the legacy of Frank Frazetta can't be ignored. And you'll hear more about it with Frank Jr. in the next segment. But Moises, thanks for coming on. And I like giant size, but I got to tell you, I prefer your Skype handle, Art House Cowboy. Oh, I'm giving away a secret. Should I not tell you?
I'll recut that
if you want.
No, I don't care.
No, I'm not going to. Let me redo that.
Hang on. Don't worry about it.
No, it's okay. I like giant size, but I got to tell you, I like another nickname for you, Art House Cowboy. I think that should be the name of your podcast, man.
Well, here's the thing. I wrote a column for a site called Hollywood Elsewhere when I was in college. He gave me free rein to write whatever I wanted, didn't edit me, just said, post something consistently and don't embarrass me, kid. And I dug the name, I dug the title, and when I got into podcasting, the central show that I say that I do, but it's been on hiatus, is called Electric Shadow, which is
– Oh, very nice.
It's a transliteralization of the Chinese word for cinema, which you
oh,
break it apart.
Oh, interesting. I had no idea. Yeah. Go on.
It's evocative. It's interesting. It was something that didn't have the word movie or cinema or any of the six words that are pretty much in all – movie podcasts out there, because it's not just a movie podcast. It's about the nation of the notion of looking at cinematic technique and cinematic storytelling in ways that it's evolved from movies to TV, even to video games.
Sure. Well, I would imagine comic page composition might probably be a fair subject as well.
Leading the eye, directing the eye to what you want people to look at. So the back catalog of that show has some pretty diverse stuff in it. Con Q&As that I've done with various people, and I can say that it is coming back. So the one plug I will permit for myself is the show is coming back. I've got an interview with one of the animators on Pixar's Coco.
Terrific.
That's going to bring it back off of hiatus. I've got an interview with Kathleen Turner.
Wow.
An interview with Mara Wilson, who has a new book out.
Equally cool.
That is outstanding. Felicia Day, Karen Allen. I've got a ridiculous array of stuff, some
Great.
Particularly unique Star Wars stuff that I'm going to time for the release of The Last Jedi. But it's much more important that you subscribe to that if you want to. There will be more podcasts than you can handle in that feed very, very soon.
That's awesome.
But back this Kickstarter. Take a look at Tim Doyle's other work at Nakatomi Inc. I'll give you the link for that, John.
Okay.
So you can plug that in at the end.
Sure.
But he runs a full service print shop doing all kinds of stuff. They set up at cons all over the place. They were just at New York Comic Con, which is where you met Frank Jr. There's your segue, Suntris.
Oh, I like
throw it. Throw to Junior.
I like it, man. There you go. Thanks, voices. I'm gonna probably take a commercial break before we get to Frank, but I appreciate the segue there. Good throwaway there.
Well, that's the thing, true believer. You gotta pay the bills one way or another. Excelsior.
Okay, let's get to our conversation with Frank Frazetta Jr. I apologize to Lori Frazetta for not being able to accommodate both of them on the call. Frank was on a phone. And it sounded too airy using the speakerphone. And so I had Frank kind of get on the handset, and it's a little bit better. But I did feel bad about that. But Frank gives Lori her due in the podcast and how instrumental she is in terms of once they took over the museum outright, running the museum and keeping things going. So as Frank says at the end, he's got some other projects coming up. I am happy to have them both back to help promote the museum, because I really believe in the cause. I think the legacy of Frazetta needs to be maintained, and this should go decades beyond. This is just like Jack Kirby. We cannot let geek history move on and let Frank Frazetta become a forgotten hero of geek history. His impact was too great and continues to reverberate today in our most popular artists as we go over some of the people that were and are such massive Frank Frazetta fans. So it's a pleasure to talk to Frank Frazetta Jr. now on Word Balloon. Frank Frazetta Jr., welcome to Word Balloon. I'm always pleased to get a chance to talk to the children of my favorite creators. It's great to have you on. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to spread the word about my father. Thank you.
Absolutely, man. And you know, this is we talked earlier in the segment about the Kickstarter campaign. I'm glad that you guys have found another revenue stream for the museum. I know mail order was always kind of, am I right, that was kind of a good revenue thing for the museum and for Frank Sr.'s business in general?
Absolutely. My mother and I ran the business pretty much from 1971 until about 2009, so she passed. And the website and the museum, and she was basically my father's agent, so she had control of his artwork. And she pushed it, and I did the social media on the website because she was not illiterate with computers, nor am I that much. But we pushed it through there, and we did very well. But then after the passing of both parents, the four siblings did what they wanted to do, so it was basically broken up a little bit more.
Sure.
So the revenue stream isn't as great as it was at one time, but we do have the museum and established that it is reopened again. So a lot of some people still don't know that, but we're working to keep this legacy going for the more so for the younger generation who has seen the art but doesn't know who the artist and the creator is. So that's really what we're trying to focus on.
I understand, and I'm glad you're keeping your dad's legacy alive, not only through his work but really his story. Is it Painting with Fire is such an amazing documentary, and I'm really glad your dad was alive to be a part of it. And also, I'm assuming that my listeners may not know that. What year did your dad have that stroke and use the loss of or lose the use of his right hand?
95, he had his first stroke, and he recovered about 85%. Then he had a minor one following that, and then he had another major one, and he was in sad shape. We thought we pretty much lost him altogether, except for his heart continually beating. But he went to a rehab center. And they worked at him for about 6 months or 3 months, and it was amazing how they turned him around because he couldn't even speak or walk, and they had him talking and walking, and actually he felt his art career was over, even though he was pretty much semi-retired. But they convinced him at the rehab that, Mr. Frazetta, your art comes from your heart and your brain. Your hand is just an extension to get it to the paper. And once he was convinced of that and worked at his first 6 months of drawings were very crude, but in a matter of a year, he basically mastered the left hand again, and he did some beautiful paintings left-handed that are hanging in the museum at this time.
That's amazing. How many left-handed pieces are at the museum? Because we only saw, I think, one or two in the documentary.
Yeah, you probably saw on the documentary, I'm not sure, I think the gorilla painting, the girl, it's like his second attempt at the cat girl, and then he did the Death Dealer number 7 left-handed.
Okay.
And then he did another painting for the WWE wrestler as well. So there's 4 paintings and quite a few drawings.
That's amazing, honestly. And really, you know, your dad was tough, man. I mean, I love those pictures of him, you know, I'm assuming in his younger years and everything. This is a big, strong guy, and I'm really glad that the therapists were able to convince him where his true talent really lied, and that his hands were just another tool. And I'm glad that he learned how to do it. That's great. There's a Batman artist, Norm Breyfogel, from the 90s, who suffered a stroke, and I know is currently not drawing. And I hope he finds inspiration and is able to do what your dad was able to do. It really is incredible.
It was. I mean, my dad, whatever he put his heart to and mind to, there was no stopping him. But there were certain things in his life he had no interest in. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about fame ever. I mean, some people may think that, but I believe in my heart, a true artist, whether it be a musician, instruments, painting, whatever it might be, it's not about the money and fame. That comes along with it, obviously, if you're that great of a talent. But he focused on living every day to the fullest, and that was his life and his goal. It was living with his family. He was not a prisoner to his art. It was a way to make a living, to keep a roof over his head. And other than that, he would drop his paintbrush in the middle of one of his masterpieces to come right outside and play stickball or softball with us without a second thought.
That's
great. If the thing was due tomorrow, he would sit there and drop it. And he said the good thing about that, he'd come back, you know, hours later, and the painting would be fresh to him. He wouldn't get, you know, it would become stagnant if he'd worked that long on one piece. And he'd overthink it, overwork it, and it becomes posed, which is exactly what his art is not.
That's amazing. And I'm glad to hear that, too, that he did have that time for family as well. Because these pieces, you know, as you well know, and being there while these things were being created, I can only imagine what that was like. I know you've drawn and painted as well and done some cartooning. You know, did you, how was it like living with your dad and this amazing talent and being able to watch this stuff from, you know, rough drawings to the completed paintings?
Well, there's a lot of misconception out there right now. Everybody, as you well aware, would think that it was about dad or about the artist and the famous artist and the creator. It was never about that. As we grew up as a young boy, dad, as an artist, would start painting at night, usually like 10 o'clock when we went to bed. With a blank canvas, we'd get up in the morning, it would be finished. And that's as simple as that.
Wow.
He put it in the oven to dry because it was oil paint. he used very small canvases, or canvas board or masonite, because living in the city, you have to take a taxi or a subway to the publisher's office, and he couldn't paint very large scale just for that reason.
Sure.
So, but it was never about dad, the famous artist. He never portrayed that, nor did he want to. It was always about dad. I mean, I wrote a book about him as a tribute to him in 2014 called The Art and Remembrances, and it was basically my life with my dad growing up, and it gave people an insight and a vision to who he was behind his art. And he wasn't a prisoner to his art. It was never about that. It was just, dad, can we do this? Dad, can we do that? And he was always there for us. Absolutely. And being home all the time, you know, with mom and dad, it was,
sure,
you know, having two parents growing up with, it wasn't like dad went to the office, we didn't see him.
Right.
He was home from morning till night with us, and he did his thing at night, through the night.
When,
kind of a vampire kind of father.
I know a lot of creative people who work from home and do the same thing, you know, family times during the day, and like you said, vampire hours at night, cartoonists and writers that operate that way, so they can spend that time with their family. I'm going to cough.
That's true. That is actually a fact, that people who are creative, their minds basically get stimulated at night, and that's why they work through the night. It's just not like the time they put aside for it. It's been a proven fact, scientific fact, that part of your brain is stimulated basically like 7 at night and later. And it's the same with me. I'm creative, and I can't lift weights or paint or draw or write in the middle of the day. It just doesn't work for me.
Interesting. So how old were you when you realized that your dad's stuff was all over the place in dorm rooms and vans? And I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and I remember well the you know, how prevalent a lot of your dad's art was, not just on the paperback covers, but the posters. And like I said, people painting their vans to look like the Frazettas and stuff like that.
I would say, well, I was born in 1957, so by around, you know, the Conan thing came out in 66, Conan the Barbarian, and you know, we used to go to bookstores. My dad would go in there and just to see if his book was on the shelf, and basically that's about the extent of it. But I would say when Mom took the business to licensing, where Valentine Books did, you know, 1 through 5 books, and the calendars started, where my dad was the forefather of the fantasy genre, and that's when it all started. Probably in 1971, we started to realize how big it was going to get, and Mom just went full boat. She was his agent, very protective of him, and basically by 71, 72, my dad was semi-retired. You know, he'd get $1,000 to do a paperback cover, retain the art, and Mom was getting $50,000-$75,000 advances for books and calendars, which is incredible at the time.
Hell yeah!
Today you can't demand that money because there's so many other imitators and other artists that, you know, are very, very talented. So I would say mid-70s is when we started realizing, you know, that's when Clint Eastwood and Sylvester Stallone, George Lucas all came to the estate, and that's when it started to be a lot of fun.
Did your dad do film conceptual art? I know he did a lot of movie posters in the 60s and 70s, but did he ever do conceptual art for films like Steranko did for Indiana Jones and things like that?
Well, he did the poster from Gauntlet with Clint Eastwood, and that's why Clint came up here in 77. In the early, I think he did What's in the Pussycat, After the Fox, Night They Read the Mystery with Peter Sellers, and Victor Mature in the 60s. But there again, the reason he jumped on that and the reason that all transpired was from 1964, he did the portrait of Ringo Starr for the back of Mad Magazine. Hollywood picked up on that, and at the time, I think he said he got $150 for that. They retained
Crazy.
The art. Hollywood picked up on that, and you know, and this is 64. They offered him $5,000 to do one of those movie posters, and that was, like he said, a year's salary at the time.
Sure.
So, and I said it wasn't about money, but he's just had his second son, and third one was on the way, I believe, the daughter, and he jumped all over it. And he did, I think, 14 in total movie posters, and that was a lot of money back in that time.
No question. And again, like you said, some of these were really our kind of classic movies, The Night They Raided Minsky's and After the Fox, the great Peter Sellers film.
Monster Party, he did all as well. Mad Monster Party was my favorite.
Oh, my God, Mad Monster Party. That's fantastic.
Yeah, did two of them for that.
Wow, that's crazy. Did Ringo ever see your dad's Mad Magazine thing?
I'm sure he has. I mean, we never met him, but I'm sure he has.
Okay.
I mean, my dad was trying so hard with my mom to get that original back. And I know they spent a lot of money trying to find out who was the owner. When they finally contacted him, they offered him like 3 times more than what it was worth, and he wouldn't give it up. So,
wow.
That's what they did love that painting. That was really a fabulous portrait of him, character.
How many private pieces are not part of the museum that are floating out there with private collectors?
He's talking about strictly oil paintings?
Yeah, paintings, but also any significant, you know, God, I love your dad's pen and ink stuff as well.
Sadly, the four siblings, my brother, myself, and 2 sisters, we split the yard up 4 ways at the end after Mom and Dad passed. So I basically have, with my wife in the museum, as far as oil paintings, probably 35 original oil paintings. And we never knew exactly how many he did in his career, but we have an index book, and I think I counted like 360 oil paintings he did over his lifetime. So we only have a small amount of his original oil paintings. And as far as pen and inks, watercolors, pencil drawings, I can tell you right now, he's done a million of them in his lifetime from the age of 3 and on.
I bet.
And we just have a smidgen of what it, you know, a tenth of a percent of what he's really done.
Wow.
But we do have a nice selection in the museum of to show you what he's done since 3 years old.
That's incredible. Yeah. You know, honestly, I do. I love every facet of your dad's career. And I know through Vanguard, I picked up his comic strip run on Johnny Comet. I'm a big fan of that, the race car comic strip that he did.
Right.
And I can't remember the name of his Jungle Man, not his Tarzan stuff. It starts, I know, with a K. Conga?
Thunder.
Thunder, of course, Thunder. Oh, man. That was like such a great find to get that oversized Bud Plant reproduction of Thunder.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, man, I mean, that's the great thing. Your dad was just so comfortable in any form of, you know, whether it was paints or pen and ink. And I imagine the rigors of comic strips and comic books and stuff. No, it's just a pleasure seeing your dad's art, you know, through the years and its evolution. But I mean, God, even in the, you know, in the 40s, the man had it.
Oh, absolutely. There was nothing. Like I said, he started drawing when he was 2 1/2. He remembers too. And growing up during the Depression, his mother and father, his father was an immigrant from Sicily, came over when I think he was 4 or 7 years old, my grandfather told me, and there was nothing in the house to draw on. And he said, at that time, as a young boy, he said, if you drew pictures, he goes, instead of being outside with the guys and the boys and the girls, whatever it was, he said, you were considered a sissy.
Okay.
So he kept it secret of his art. And he said he'd go in the basement and look through old books or whatever he can find for a blank piece of page, or even as far as toilet paper, he said, to draw on. That's how much it was in his blood and the desire to want to do so. He said he'd also take his mom's soap and do little carvings on it until his mom found it and basically gave him a couple of good whacks in his behind. So during the Depression, his parents weren't even aware that he drew. And not until 8 years old, one of the art teachers in school called his parents in to let him, you know, why isn't this boy in art school? And they said, we didn't even know he even drew at all. So basically my dad said they gave the parents hell and they threw him right into the Brooklyn Academy of Fine Arts at 8 years old and immediately became the instructor's main student. Yeah, prodigy child. And my dad loved it.
That's amazing.
So his mentor passed 4 years later and was going to take him to Italy, which would have been interesting. How that would have came out, but really the most interesting about my dad, and we always discussed it, was he was a tremendous athlete, very physical, and in 1947 he was drafted by the New York Giants baseball team to play center field.
Oh my God!
And the offer was $3,000 for a year, so that wasn't very enticing at the time, and he declined it. And a year later he came back and offered him the same thing, maybe $3,500. He said, "No, I just can't do it." And I always asked him, I said, "Dad, what would have happened if you would have taken up that offer?" You know, certainly there was no money in it at the time, but it was his true love, art. And he said, well, he goes, art was in my blood. He goes, certainly never would have reached this magnitude of artwork in my collection. He goes, but I would have certainly been drawing on the airplanes and bus rides, but it would have been a sad loss, because not that we would have ever known about it, but I mean, it's really great that we have what we have left.
No question. Absolutely. Well, so
I mean, we hear so many people coming to see my wife and I, and it's great to hear. And it never gets tiring, because they always say it probably gets tired of hearing how great your dad was and how he inspired us. It never gets old, because it's just the magnitude of his talent, what it did to other people who changed their whole life's goal at what they wanted to focus on for a career and turn it into art in some form because of my father. It's just. It's amazing.
Well, I mean,
so really looking at it a whole different way.
It doesn't surprise me. And again, I'm always pleased when, and unfortunately, we lost Bernie Wrightson, but guys like that. And I know Bradstreet is such a fan, and so many great. Brahm, of course, I know gives it up to your dad in terms of being the inspiration for what he does. How about the celebrities? What celebrity fans were there of your father's?
Oh, like I said, Clint Eastwood, Stallone, Lucas, Spielberg, Schwarzenegger. There's hundreds and hundreds of them. I heard through, you know, Robert Rodriguez, the producer, Cameron.
Sure.
Anyone you talk to in Hollywood who's up in the film industry, Ralph Bakshi, they can say, because there isn't a producer in Hollywood who does that sort of film industry, you know, fantasy, science fiction, has their walls covered with posters of my dad's artwork. So they're inspired by that. George Lucas said there'd be no Star Wars if it wasn't for my dad's book, Rogers, from the 50s. And he came in the museum and pointed out different pictures that inspired him to create the Death. The Death Dealer was his inspiration for Darth Vader.
The helmet.
And the Buck Rogers, Buck Rogers was his inspiration for Luke Skywalker. And there's a cover that he did for Buck Rogers in, I think, 1955, that you could see as hairy ape, sort of a Chewbacca creature walking through the doorway, and said that was an inspiration for Chewbacca. So it all came from that.
That's incredible.
So it all stemmed from my father, including Stallone. I mean, Stallone was a little different celebrity. He was more into himself than the other celebrities that came out. And the funny thing was, most of the celebrities were very reluctant to come out and meet my dad, because based on the art that he created, I mean, Clint Eastwood told it right to my face. I was afraid to call your dad and actually to come out. He goes, I honestly thought your dad would have dreadlocks in his hair, wear these weird clothes and bones in his nose, like a zombie. That's how scared they were of my father, until he came out and he's, you know, the most mellow, laid back, down to earth guy you'd ever meet. That's what's so great about him.
Well, it came across in the documentary, and it was great to see that. And you mentioned Ralph Bashke. I've had him on the podcast, and their collaboration on Fire and Ice, the animated movie from the early 80s. I really appreciated that. And, no one can replicate what your dad did. And I know you already know that, but that's the thing. I really do think it's amazing. I mean, your dad really did, you know, kind of, he was like Sir Edmund Hillary on top of Everest, man. And everyone else is just trying to reach the pinnacle if they can, but nobody can reach your dad's level, man.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than just being creative. I mean, he actually lived a lot of his paintings. Being physical, he knew what the limitations were with a human body and what they should look like. I mean, when Schwarzenegger was to play the role for Conan, my dad immediately turned down helping with the film. He said, because he's a muscle weightlifter. He said, right. He's not Conan. Conan's swinging an axe and a sword. He's supposed to look lean and muscular, not every part of his body blown up. That's not how it is with a Viking or a barbarian. So as simple as that, he knew what the limitations were, and he never used models except for maybe lighting once in a while. He used me and my mom for the lighting aspects on certain paintings. And he said, if you use a model, you're restricted to a pose and then become tight and stiff. And that's what happens to a lot of artists.
That's incredible.
As you can see in a lot of paintings.
So a lot.
And another problem is that they render the whole painting. You know, my dad, if you look at his original artwork, it's hard. You can't pick it up on a paperback book that's 5 inches by 7.
Sure.
To see the original art before you with the lighting hitting it, to see how my dad had a focal point where he forced you without even knowing, subconsciously, he drew you into the part of the painting that was the most important. And the backgrounds are always just suggestions of a castle. It wasn't a castle with a window and a door and the steps and the cracks and the stone. It was just a vague outline of it to where your eyes would catch it, but you'd just be drawn into the focal point, whatever that was in that painting. And you can't pull yourself away from it. And you can go back and look at the same painting 100 times, and each time you'll see something different because you're so drawn into what he wanted you to see. And that's the really, truly amazing part of that is artwork.
That's fantastic. Tell us about the museum. What do you want people to know beyond the obvious? And again, being able to study these paintings up close. But what are you proud of as far as what you guys present in the museum?
Okay. Well, the museum originally reopened. The original one was 85 in a small building in town. Moved it to Florida in 92, I believe. And we moved it back for security reasons. And Florida wasn't a place for my dad to live. It was too hot. So we built this beautiful museum on the estate. It looks like a Spanish villa. Now, in 2000, we opened it up a year prior to the documentary. And it was basically a focused on oil paintings, 92 oil paintings on the wall. And that was it. But we've learned through experience and people coming in and speaking, the true artist, even though he became famous and world known for his oil paintings, the artist want to see his preliminaries in the process.
Sure.
And how it became a finished oil painting. And when, after mom and dad passed and it was closed for a few years, my wife and I reopened it in 2014, I believe. And I present the museum as in chronological order. It starts out with his early art from 3 years old, 8 years old, then you see the progression and the transition of a young artist who doesn't understand anatomy quite yet, but has the gifts based on what you see on the wall. And it just transpires eventually into his finished art. And we have very personalized things in there, like his golf clubs, his camera collection, everything related to my dad, so you'd know who he was behind the scenes.
Absolutely.
Not just the artist, so you could see his sketches, his watercolors, his early art from a young boy, and just everybody that comes who's seen it before and after and love it, they like it more this way. It's just more telling about who the artist was.
As you said, go ahead. I don't want to step on you there. Go ahead if you had.
My wife worked very hard. I mean, my wife has become a huge fan, just like my mom. It's become, before it was always Frank and Ellie, and now it's Frank and Lori.
That's beautiful.
She runs the business like my mom. She protects it, and we never get tired of it. It's a lot of work, and to know that, that you sit there and look at this artwork and how valuable it is, and you can sell a piece of artwork and retire the rest of your life, but once you do that, it's gone, and there's nothing to appreciate that art. Somebody else has it at their house, and the fans don't get a chance to see it and they'll be inspired by it. So that's why we work so hard to keep this thing going. And we reach out to the fans to come out and visit us, to go to the website and buy products to help us keep this thing rolling. And that's our main goal.
Understood. And I'm glad you're doing that. And, you know, I'm reminded of, again, of Indiana Jones. This should be in a museum. And it's like, you're damn right it should. Certainly the Frazetta stuff. And did he ever teach, young artists process?
He's taught Ken Kelly, who's an artist today, a very popular artist. He taught him. That was my mom's nephew. And he wanted me so badly to be an artist. And I just rebelled against it at an early age. I just didn't want to be an artist. It has to be in your blood. And
absolutely,
you have to have love for it, because it's something you have to motivate yourself to do. So around when I was about, maybe 35 or 40, I sat down with him and started doing some cute little drawings, nothing spectacular. And he gave me the anatomy book. He said, here's Bertram's anatomy book. Copy this book and then get back, come over when you're done and let me take a look at him. And he said, I did this whole book in one night. Well, it's easy for him to say.
Sure.
So I did about two pages of a bicep and a forearm and a tricep and not realizing, oh, I think I got it now. I know how to work this. And as soon as the arm moves, everything you just learned goes away, because now the muscles are twisted and contorted to a different area. And it's like, oh my God, I got to relearn this again. It's like, and it became so much like trigonometry. I said, you know what, Pop, this isn't for me. I'm sorry. And he was very bummed out about it. And then there's a few drawings that I did do in paintings I put on the internet. Some people loved them and said, great, keep it up. And you always get the critics out there. So I'll never be as good as his father. And my dad goes, he goes, get used to it. He goes, I have people criticizing my art. He goes, and those are the guys who can't draw a straight line. He goes, don't get affected by it. Don't read into it. It doesn't matter. I said, Dad, but I can never be as good as you. And he goes, well, join the club. I said, well, I don't want to be in that club, Pop.
So, I hear you, man.
So I just kind of stay away from it. So it just wasn't for me. So I did some little cute little things over the years.
Yeah,
and then I copied quite a few of my dad's pieces.
Wasn't like a little cartooning thing? Like, wasn't it ants or something like that? I remember seeing
Yeah. I did quite a few cute little ant ones. But then later when my dad gave me a few lessons, my ant drawings became almost like realistic cartoons. It became very detailed and structured. And I just gave up on it. I said, nah, that's not for me. And I opened my own business and I did very well. So
I understand, man. No, that's, you know, Jack Nicklaus Jr. could never play as well as his father. And that's it's tough, man. I can appreciate that. I think it is tough, and I'm glad that instead you're able to celebrate your father and it not become a frustration. You know, I think that's really important. And again, I mean, I'm glad that, you know, it sounds like you had a good, loving relationship with your dad. I hope so. It sounds like you did.
Oh, absolutely. It was so close. It was as close as it could possibly be.
That's beautiful.
I said, I miss him dearly.
That's excellent.
Especially, he lived right across the field. He's a stone throw away. And, you know, I'd see him just about every night. And I had four children. And then, you know, the grandchildren came. And he's so excited when the kids came over every day. He just, whatever he was doing, he'd drop it. And they'd just play checkers with him or draw with him. And sadly, my daughter, Nicole, got the gift that my dad had, like I did as well. But she liked to draw. And sadly, my dad isn't here. But if he was, I can't imagine how great she'd be right now.
Oh, wow.
She is incredibly artistic, and it's sad that he's not here to teach her, because my dad simplified the whole drawing process to where there's a process from beginning to end, but he knew what was important and what wasn't, so he'd eliminate what really didn't have any bearing on the final product and result in painting. And he would just get right to the point, and it was easy to learn from. That's why he's so emulated, because you look at his art, it looks so simplistic, and it is, but everything's in the perfect spot.
Absolutely.
That's the difference.
Oh, my God.
You look at some of his early pen and inks, the women are gorgeous, and you look at her face, there's really an eye, no nose, very little lip, if all, and if at all, she's gorgeous. He's my dad, because your mind fills in the blank. As long as the other parts are put in the correct spot. Yeah, that's easy for you to say, Pop.
Wow. I'm glad I ran
into you. He did it without thought.
He did it without thought. That's amazing. I'm glad I ran into you at New York Comic Con at the heavy metal booth. And,
yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I was just going to the small press area because it was one of the few places you could walk and breathe because of the crowds in on the main floor and down in Artist Alley. But it was great to see that in heavy metal, there's some Frazetta paintings that had never been printed before, right?
Yeah. Rain and Wizardry was one of them, yep.
That's cool.
That was great. Yeah, done in 1964. That was very erotic. sexually explicit painting that over the years my dad one by one removed the male anatomy, so it wasn't so embarrassing to myself or to get to speak about it. So now it sits in a museum on an easel, and it's just a classic painting. Very few people have seen, and we do have a lithograph out now of it. So my mom never wanted to expose that painting, but now that it's been cleaned up and it looks fabulous. It's one of his top 10 paintings that he created, for sure.
That's amazing. What can you tell us about Death Dealer? I mean, that's that and his Conan stuff are really, I think, the things that people think of. And, of course, the Molly Hatchet painting. So first, let's talk about Death Dealer and coming up with that concept.
Well, Death Dealer, this was created in 1873. That time, my dad was semi-retired. And he'd have a few artist friends come over on occasion in the house, and there was these two critics, he said, that were just bashing my father because he did all the great Conan paintings through the 60s and the creepy, eerie paintings, Catgirl and right down the line, Night Stalker. And these two critics are out there bashing my dad, saying that was a fluke what he did and he'll never do it again, blah, blah, blah. And it irritated my dad a little bit, but he never took it to heart. But every time his friends came over, they'd open the article up and show it how they were bashing my dad. And little by little, he just got more upset. And finally, they left him. He goes, I'm going to get these guys back, finally. I'm just tired of it. And I said, what are you going to do, kick their ass? He goes, no, because I'd like to. He goes, but I'm gonna bury him right now. And he went in the studio, and he created the Civil War and Death Dealer back-to-back.
Wow.
And when those two came out, he goes, they went away. And that was his goal. But the Death Dealer has been, you know, the Conan the Barbarian was his interpretation of Robert E. Howard's character.
Certainly.
Which basically turned this small cult following into a huge franchise, but it wasn't his character, it was his interpretation of it.
Right.
But Death Dealer is his creation from start to finish, and you'll see a lot of fabulous things on the Death Dealer next year, like we spoke about earlier. So
that's cool. That's fantastic. Hey, man, I was so excited when, and I can't remember which publisher it was, maybe within the last 10 years, when they had stories inspired by your dad's covers. Comic stories. I forget what comic book series.
Oh, yeah.
It was J
Image
Photos.
Comics.
Was it Image?
Yeah, J Photos, Image Comics. Yeah, back in around 2007 or 8, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Those were gorgeous.
The only downside to the Death Dealer stories and novels to this point was all the writers and screenplay writers who came to speak to my dad about the character and how to write the story. The funny thing, I'd be sitting in the studio when they'd come in with their pencil and paper and tape recorders, and they say, okay, let's get to it. Tell us a little bit about the character. He said, well, what do you want to know? He goes, well, who is he? Where does he come from? What does he do? He goes, how the hell I know? He goes, what do you mean that? He goes, I did the painting. I don't know nothing about him. He goes, well, you created him. He goes, it's basically my interpretation of death on a battlefield. He goes, what more can I tell you?
That's cool.
He goes, well, tell us about him. He goes, well, I can't tell you about him. He's a bad dude. You don't want to mess with him. He does this thing and he's gone. And that's about where he left him off. And that's why all the stories to this day were based on the writer's thought process on the character, but not my father's. So over the years from that point on, my father and I discussed it. I'd throw things at him that either stick and say, yeah, I like that, or he'd say, nah. And so over the years, I compiled quite a good glossary of how it should be played out. And basically, I did it. And basically, the only downside to the character was my dad did the original in 73. He never wanted to do another one after that because he said, that's as good as it's going to get.
Okay.
I don't have to do another one. But from the pressure from Mom and Hollywood to where it should be a film because Conan was doing so well and vice versa back and forth, my dad was forced into doing a second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth one. And what he did was he exposed some of the skin under the armor plating and the chain link story showed the skin even though it looked deathly and ghostly, like a greenish white. You know, it's interpretation of like dead skin or whatever, ghoulish skin.
Sure.
He never wanted to do that, and it gave away a lot of the mystique of the character. And he knew he made a mistake when he did that.
Interesting.
So that was his main mistake. So I can't discuss what I've done, but next time we speak, I can tell you a little bit about how I focused on the character.
That sounds great. No, I appreciate even that much too, because again, we just don't know where the inspiration for these things come from. What about the Molly Hatchet album cover?
Well, there's three of them. There was the Berserker, there was Dark Kingdom, and there was Death Dealer number one. And they basically just licensed those pieces of art for the cover. He didn't do it for them.
I see.
That was a licensing deal.
Okay, because, I had seen Death Dealer, obviously, before Molly Hatchet, and I had forgotten about the second one, and Berserker is the one that always comes to mind. So what do you remember what he created Berserker for originally?
Berserker was just for the Conan novels, and Dark Kingdom, I think, was just out of his head. That's one of his inspirations, just of a Viking warrior. That's about it.
Okay.
And Berserker painting was sold to Kirk Hammack, the guitarist from Metallica, in 2010 for $1 million. That was the first $1 million painting my dad sold.
Wow.
That was the first one. And since then, there's been many.
I believe it, man. No, so, I understand, and I'm glad the museum is holding on to as many pieces as it has, because again, it's. And really, I want you guys obviously to succeed. So to give us the URL, the website to go and purchase these things. I mean, the Kickstarter is there for the four shirts, and we discussed that. But yeah, beyond that, you know, how else can people support the museum?
Okay. Well, if you don't take it to the museum here in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, it's about an hour and a half from Manhattan, an hour and a half from Philadelphia. It's pretty much centralized. But the museum website address is frazettaartmuseum.com or frazettamuseum.com, and to get you there, either one. And that basically gives you a huge assortment of memorabilia that we've licensed out and created ourselves in the last 4 years. So we have posters, books, master's collection. Now, the master's collection is your clay that I created to where it's transferred to canvas. And then when I get it in-house, I hand color enhance it myself.
Wow.
Next to the original to make it as close as possible, and I texturize it with brush strokes to where it gives it that depth, you know, to where people just, you can't distinguish it between some of the originals. That's how good they become at the end.
That's great.
And we sell those with Italian wood frames, and they're $7.99 to $1,000, which is inexpensive for what's put into them at all. And they're very collectible, they're limited, and they're about as close as you're going to get to an original that you can't buy, and most people can't afford. But we're not selling ours anyway, so that's the first thing. But we have everything they could pretty much imagine on the website right now, but there's always new product becoming available as we go on, and the more help from the fans, the quicker we can do the next statue or writing a new book or whatever it might be.
Excellent. And your book obviously is available, I'm assuming, at the museum and through Amazon.
Yes.
And the like.
And, correct. If you buy it through the website or call us up directly, I can personalize it for you.
Oh, terrific.
I can personalize it to a husband or girlfriend, so that I can do that as well.
That's excellent, man. Hey, seriously, I'm so happy to help spread the word, and I'm really glad that the museum is reopened. And I can only speak for myself and say when things were rough with your sisters and siblings and everything, I was really glad that you were out there protecting your dad's legacy and understood where you were coming from. I think initially the reports kind of made it sound like a crazy situation. God only knows, because I mean, everyone knows family drama. It can get kind of ridiculous. Yeah. But thank you for preserving your dad's legacy through the museum. And again, yeah, I'm really happy to help you guys keep things going, because, again, I really want the next generations to, in the same way that Norman Rockwell is regarded and stuff, your dad needs to be on that level of, you know, Mount Rushmore appreciation of his body of work and what he means to the art world.
I truly appreciate that. Let everybody know where we are, and, you know, not so much to me, but my wife, Lori, has dedicated her entire days to that museum. She actually worked harder to keep that museum than I have, so she's owed more of the gratification than I do at this point. So when you get to the museum, just be glad to, you know, I appreciate it. Just thank her personally, because she has devoted her life to that museum at this point. And thank you for your time, for helping us out.
Wow, a real pleasure talking to Frank Frazetta Jr. If you want to support the museum, there's two ways to do it. First of all, again, the Kickstarter campaign is going on. There's still about a week left. And if you search for Kickstarter, Frank Frazetta World's limited edition silkscreen prints by Tim Doyle. So if you put in Frank Frazetta and Tim Doyle, you'll likely get the proper Kickstarter. But we've got the link to it as well at warballoon.com. And we also have the link to the Frazetta Museum, which is frazettamuseum.com. And, man, you can see a picture of the beautiful Spanish villa outside And it also mentions a lot of other great product going on that you could purchase to help the museum out. And by all means, go to the museum. It's open Thursdays through Sundays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The number at the museum is 570-242-6180. And it's 141 Museum Lane, East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. Man, I got to ask Pants from Comic Geek Speak if he's gone to the Frazetta Museum, because I'm sure that's up his alley. But really a pleasure, and happy to help the Frazetta Museum spread the word on today's Word Balloon. I hope you enjoyed the show. It was, again, brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you very much, League, for your support. And you can help me out and subscribe at Word Balloon by going to patreon.com/wordballoon or wordballoon.com and clicking on the Patreon ad. So thank you very much for listening today. We got great episodes still to come for November. Look at that, man. November. We've already had four episodes, and it's the 10th of November as I'm releasing today's Frazetta episode. And also, if you haven't noticed, IDW Sarah Gatos, the wonderful editor that runs all the Star Trek books, we have a wonderful conversation about the current product. And certainly Star Trek Discovery comes up. I can't help it. I am, as a Trek fan, this is like the best thing that has happened since, you know, the debut of Enterprise. And I'm really kind of bummed. I mean, you know, the 2009 and the J.J. movies as well. Anytime there's new Star Trek product, that's my jam, man. Can't help it. So if you enjoy Star Trek, I mean, I'm sure you're going to enjoy the conversation that Sarah and I have. And check that out as well. But thanks for listening today. And thank you again, Moises Chuan, for also helping out on today's podcast and talking about the Kickstarter campaign. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2017.